This week's episode of the FitCast is brought to you by the PTAdvantage.com, an online personal training software to help you save time and make more money. It is hands down the best resource I've found to work with clients and athletes remotely. You can check them out at the PTAdvantage.com. Well, welcome to this week's episode of the FitCast. This is episode number 268. I'm Kevin Larrabee, and I'm very happy to be joined again by Brad Pilon of Eat Stop Eat. Brad, how you doing?
Good. How you doing, man?
Very good, thanks. And, you know, it seems like we were just talking a little bit beforehand, and every single time that you come on, exponentially fasting, intermittent fasting becomes more and more popular, so we seem to be getting more and more questions and more detailed, I guess.
Yeah, it's got its own legs now. It's really, I mean, it's reaching that kind of almost cult fad status, which is both horrible and kind of good at the same time, I guess.
Well, what's that experience been like? Because we were talking a little bit off the air about how you've even, you know, translated the book into other languages for, you know, Asian market and stuff like that.
It's crazy. I mean, it went from, you know, in early 2007 when this thing was launched, it was sort of defending myself constantly and then and just trying to get people to maybe even consider the idea of fasting. And then it got to the point where, like, last year I had, like, documentary shows showing up at my door wanting to do, like, I did a documentary for a major news station in Korea. And I was trying to figure out, like, I'm like, is it in Korean? Like, I don't, like, and they flew someone in to do, like, in my house doing Korean. And so it's one of those things where it's scary in my initial, you know, a comment would always be like, no, thanks. But I figured, let's just do it. And it was a fun experience. I said yes to it on like a Monday, and they're in my house on like the following like Wednesday, like 2 days later. So no real prep time or anything. But it's gotten to that point where it was a worthy enough story to fly people over to Canada, the middle of, you know, I'm middle of nowhere Canada where I am. So they flew people in. At first, they flew them into Montreal. And the people are trying to figure out how to drive my house from Montreal, which is like a 10-hour drive. I'm like, you need to drive flying to Hamilton or Toronto, right? So then they flew, like they fly back over to a different airport. So it was crazy, but it's that level where people are seeing value of doing the documentaries for it. But it's scary at the same time because, I mean, really intermittent fasting is kind of like saying eating, right? There's thousands and thousands of different types of intermittent fasting styles. You can do it just about any way you want. So it'd be kind of like the way people are treating intermittent fasting now. To me, it's almost as asinine as saying that, you know, paleo and vegan are the same thing because they both eat, right? So when they kind of look at intermittent fasting, like, yeah, well, these diets fast, therefore they're the same thing. And that's what's kind of I'm trying to explain away with the latest version of Eat Stop Eat, is that there is intermittent fasting and it's awesome, but there's specific ways to do it. And the authors who wrote it, in their particular way, they had a reason. It wasn't just sort of an arbitrary guesswork thing. So that's a lot of what I've been working on now, is just sort of clarifying Eat Stop Eat's position in the intermittent fasting world.
When I get back out to Japan, I got to ask people if it's starting to make it over there, because again, another thing we were talking about before we started recording is just the interest that the Japanese public has on new diets and new ways on, you know, getting leaner. Everyone's trying, like, I swear to God, everyone you talk to in that country is trying to lose like 5 kilograms. That's what they'll all say. Everyone's trying to lose 5 kilograms. So I'll have to poke around a little bit while I'm out there. So we get a lot of questions from the audience, so we'll jump right into those, and we're definitely we'll talk about some of the new additions at the end. But Martina had a question. She says that I know Brad's talking about this topic in the new Eat Stop Eat edition, but could he talk a little bit more why fasting is different for women opposed to men? She says she's had fantastic results from fasting, so she's just curious.
Yeah, absolutely. So the concept of there being a gender difference in – well, okay, first off, the concept that we have a gender difference in metabolism is not new. There's entire books on it. A really good one by actually – Mark Turnipolsky, literally called Gender Differences in Metabolism, is a great place for anybody to start if they're interested in this area. But when it comes to specifically gender differences in fasting, this really got brought up about this time last year. And there was maybe one or two blog posts that came out on the topic. They were well-written. They raised some very good questions. And they were kind of the initial ones that got me on this roll of thinking this should be a major part of the next update. Since then, unfortunately, there's been probably about a dozen, a half dozen blog posts that are the typical, like, oh, me too, I want the same awesome traffic you're getting by bashing, you know, fasting and saying that women shouldn't ever do it under any circumstances ever, because, you know, that sort of contrarian view will always get you internet hits, and that's what it's all about. So there was some really good information that I was able to dig through, and then there was a whole bunch of just misinformation that I really had to get through, find what studies they're talking about, and kind of go from there. What I found was that there are some very interesting gender differences, but I think what we're really seeing is a not so much a gender difference in fasting as much as a gender difference in what you're allowed to talk about and vocalize. And this sounds kind of weird, but I'm going to kind of explain it. With women, when they overtrain, and this has nothing to do with fasting right now, but when they overtrain, they can go through something called the female athlete triad, right? Where they become in a large caloric deficit, either through dieting or simply not being able to make up the amount of calories they're burning through their activities. Think, you know, triathletes, that sort of thing. You just burn insane amount of calories and just can't make up the intake for their normal daily intake. They have excessive amounts of exercise, and they have a very low body fat count. That sort of triad predisposes these women to having hormonal irregularities that often leads to problems with their menstrual cycle. The interesting thing about women is they do have a menstrual cycle, so they have a monthly check and balance, right, where they kind of know when not something's not quite right, right? It's either, oh, wow, something's wrong, or I'm pregnant, one of the two things. So they're very in tune with what's going on with their body. And it is absolutely true that when stresses build up, and stresses is can be fasting, can be dieting, can be exercising, can even be stress at work, can be mental stress, can be the stress of not being happy with your body, whatever the case may be, when those stresses build up, it can manifest in these sort of irregularities in their reproductive hormones. That's not new, and it's not specific to fasting in any way. It's just specific to, I guess you could call it a reproductive marker of overtraining or just overstressing. The gender difference is that the exact same thing happens to guys. We're just really not allowed to talk about it as much. We don't have the same markers, right? And if Kevin, if you were to go to your doctor and be like, wow, you know, I've been training really hard, you know, I've been trying to get in shape, but I feel really lethargic and kind of exhausted. You know, I would bet 9 times out of 10, your doctor's not going to say, well, Kevin, I'm going to check your testosterone levels. Mm-hmm. And if you went in and said, doc, I'd like my testosterone levels checked, I'm really lethargic, there's a high chance you would get talked out of it, because, you know, anybody under the age of 40 going in wanting your testosterone levels checked gets, especially if you're even remotely well-muscled, they'll look at you as if, you're like, yeah, I know why you're here, right? Like, you're either on steroids or you're trying to get steroids from me. I'm not playing your game, right? Mm-hmm. So, there's a bit of a taboo around guys, A, talking about just being exhausted, moody, depressed, etc. And then there's a secondary taboo that we're not really allowed to talk about a testosterone in sort of the realm of medicine. So the gender difference, the main one, is that men and women both handle stress in very similar ways. And that is when it becomes overbearing on the body, one of the first sort of hormonal markers of that is your reproductive hormones. Right. So the general concept out there was that there was a fair body of women who were very lean women, who were very, very active women, who were doing dieting. And then when they added fasting in, it just didn't feel right. They were exhausted. They felt like crap. They didn't want to train, etc. My argument back to that is that I'm pretty sure there's an equal amount of men in the same boat who just don't vocalize it. Right. Because it's all sort of stress management. So what I see is fasting is a stress. Just like weight training, just like running, just like dieting. And it's the same type of stress as the stress you get at work or at home, etc. You may know the difference between the stress of a weight training session and the stress of being yelled at by your spouse. Your body doesn't really know that difference. So the reaction is the same. So what I'm seeing is a very large increase in the amount of people who are just overstressed. I mean, it's like a systemic overtraining that includes like a mental overtraining. And they're the people who, you know, they've added fasting into an already way too stressful lifestyle without any balance, and it's seen some issues. So there are some small gender differences. Men and women seem to be slightly different in how they handle longer fasts. So when you get past that 24-hour mark, when you go into the 48 and 72 hour mark, there is a difference. And that difference stems from the fact that women will be burning and releasing more fat during a fast than men. So they will have more fat being released from their body fat stores, more fat in their bloodstream towards the later stages of a 60, 72 hour fast. But in terms of the shorter fast, the shorter 24 hour type fast, I mean, if anything, what we're seeing is that women are more protected from some of the negatives that happen with fasting. They have a better check and balance on a lot of their hormones, including their thyroid and their cortisol, et cetera. But what they're not protected, more protected on guys for, is just the overall stress load. So I think what we're really seeing is manifestations of just simply people who are chronically overstressed and are kind of missing some of the fundamental aspects of at least my approach to fasting, which was that Eat Stop Eat was designed and always will be designed to be a replacement for strict dieting. Like, it was literally meant to be, hey, I know that you guys have tried traditional dieting, et cetera. I'd like you to try something different. Not, hey, I know you guys are trying traditional dieting and you're in a 1,000 calorie deficit. I'd like you to throw fasting on top of that, please. And I think that's a lot of what we're seeing is people throwing fasting on top of obsessive compulsive amounts of exercise, obsessive compulsive chronic dieting, and then they throw fasting in on top of that and are shocked to find that sometimes they just don't feel well. So there's some gender differences in there, but what I really think the benefit of those blog posts was is it's making people more and more aware of the fact there are overstressing phenomena. They happened long before fasting ever came out, and we have to be aware of the overall workload we're placing on our body, trying to get lean and jacked as quickly as possible and hit that envious 0% body fat everybody seems to be reaching these days.
Yeah, I think you bring up a great point. I mean, from what I've seen from internet chatter and stuff like that, it almost seems like people are, a large majority of people out there might not think they are, but they could be overtraining, just because it seems like if you get into this whole fitness thing, you get into it hard. You see the CrossFit crowd that goes super nuts and really hard every single time they train. It's really interesting stuff.
They do CrossFit, but then they also do some weight training, and then they do some Olympic lifting. They rock climb, right? Then they do their Pilates or the yoga. It's really the fitness world has become a kind of a hobbyist thing, right? Mm-hmm. You're a collector. And so, what we're finding is that people just, you've completely lost the ability to kind of tune in with your body and be like, hey, what am I doing here, right? What's happening? Instead, you push until some expert tells you to stop pushing instead of sort of listening to your body and going, maybe I should stop. The best analogy for me, or I guess way to word it, is that Eat Stop Eat or any form of intermittent fasting should typically be a replacement for your diet, not an accelerator. It's not some sort of fat loss accelerator you add on top of your diet. But that's what a lot of people are kind of using it as, and that's what I kind of want to move people away from.
Good call. All right, next question that we have comes from Chris. He wanted a discussion on working out and eating for aesthetics as opposed to functional goals. A lot of people preach the latter, but getting the okay from the prior is rare.
Yeah, well, I'm an aesthetics guy, so I'm okay for that. The my general philosophies that we developed when working with the Adonis Effect program or the Venus Factor program, which are programs based on the goal of your workouts is simply to change the metrics of your body. So a couple of key circumference measurements, not a sport specific goal, not a power in the gym type goal, but just simply a I want to look better goal. So in terms of an eating approach to that goal, depending on where you are, if you're trying to actually gain muscle, right, or even just you're not in a sort of a weight loss mode, the simplest advice I give people is I want you to eat as much as you can without getting fat. I mean, if you kind of break it down to what it's supposed to be, that's roughly it, right? You should be able to eat and understand what the level is that you can eat up to without getting fat, and that should be a level that ensures you that you can build the amount of muscle you need to kind of create an aesthetic body without giving you that horrible feeling of having to put on 30 pounds of fat so you can gain 3 pounds of muscle type of thing. So that's the approach I really like to take. When it comes to dieting, obviously I like the sort of Eat Stop Eat approach where you spend the majority of your time eating at maintenance, right? So if you're fasting once a week, that's 6 days of maintenance eating. If you're fasting twice a week, it's five. But in general, the concept I like is as much time sort of in maintenance as possible. I don't like too much time spent over maintenance because I view overeating is just as large a stress as dieting. And I don't want people to spend chronic amounts of time dieting, because I'd much prefer sort of an eat, stop, eat method where your dieting is done in chunks and the rest of the time you're close to maintenance eating. And for aesthetics, that seems to be the trick that works the best. For me, anyways.
For the next question, we're going to be heading to Sean. And this, I think we might have hit on this last time, but like whether it's calorie-free beverages or whatnot, he wanted the okay to drink black coffee while fasting.
You have my permission to drink black coffee while you're fasting. A note on coffee, because I've noticed the occasional fasting will make you a raving coffee addict stuff going on online. So when I'm not fasting, I drink two cups of coffee. They're both drank before noon. They both have cream in them. When I'm fasting, I drink two cups of coffee. They're both drank before noon, and they're both black. And that's the only difference. I don't drink eight cups of coffee on the days I'm fasting. I talk about coffee a lot on Twitter and Facebook. It's something fun to talk about. Just like I talk about Scotch or Guinness, doesn't mean I'm drinking bottles of it a day. But in general, yeah, you can drink any calorie-free beverage when you're fasting. And I'm all for, I mean, if you want something really, really cool and productive to do, try to do your fast with just water. But if you can't do that, I'm cool with anything that's calorie-free. The whole goal is a 24-hour period of abstaining from calorie intake. But if you want, I'd like you to always take in fluids. It's not a dry fast by any means.
How about, let's talk a little bit about metabolic damage. We had a question from Clement. He'd like to know your opinion on metabolic damage. Recently, many pros have been talking about it. Do you believe there is such a thing? Should someone who's overweight and practicing prolonged caloric restriction, but who has stalled at a certain body weight, look at, to cut calories further, or could they be suffering from metabolic damage?
Okay, so we have a three-point answer here. The first answer is, does metabolic damage exist? I mean, first thing is we got to define it. Okay, so I'm thinking metabolic damage, the way I view the word metabolic, I think metabolism, I think hormone profiles, et cetera. I'm not sure if that's what they mean or just simply like a metabolic rate type of thing. But either way, I'll say that when you look at the extremes, when you look at competing fitness models, when you look at competing bodybuilders or even some competing athletes, the extremes they put their body through, not unlike what we just talked about with the gender differences, the extremes they put their body through can cause some damage. I mean, anybody who's been to a fitness show and seen a guy or a girl on the day of contest, you kind of get a feel that maybe that day wasn't the healthiest day, right? That maybe, you know, you saw them 2-3 weeks ago and they just looked amazing, like a superhero. And then for the last 2 weeks, you kind of think they looked a bit sick, right? You are pushing to the extreme. There's no way that being a fitness model, male or woman, is not an extreme sport. The body fat percentages are obscenely low. The dehydration is extremely low. The drug use is often extremely high, or at least compounded. The approach was stressful. The mental anguish of trying to change your body and hit some sort of perfection or perfect ideal is stressful. And I think these people come out of it with some damage. And I'm not sure if the damage is purely physiological as much as there might be some psychological damage too. But I'm not saying everybody, but I'm saying there is the odd person who comes out of that just a little out of whack, for the use of scientific term. So it does exist that way. Should we be taking that data out to the average person? I don't think so. But at the same time, I don't think we should take that training protocol out to the average person either. Copying what those people do in your attempt to get beach ready, I think, is a silly approach. So there's a chance that there's like actual metabolic hormonal, not damage is the wrong word, dysregulation occurring as a result of getting to, you know, dangerously low levels of body fat combined with extremely high levels of exercise, extreme dieting that may include, you know, avoiding entire macronutrient groups for prolonged periods of time. Combined with the possible use of even for the women, I mean, lighter drugs, but include stimulants and thyroid hormones and light androgens, et cetera. There's some issues that I could see definitely happening there. Does that mean that the average person who's been dieting to try to, you know, get down to a healthy body weight would see the same metabolic damage? It really depends on how they're dieting. I have not seen it in sort of, you know, your average weight loss study, but your average weight loss study is supervised, right? So if anything really weird were to happen, you'd be addressing that subject directly. So most studies, you're doing some sort of blood work, some sort of hormonal profiling during the course of the study. So you'd know if it was happening, you'd reassess. For the average person, I guess my comment would be, you know, I kind of developed this newfangled style of eating where you fast once or twice a week, but on the other times you're eating at maintenance, and it might be a better approach for you than just being chronically dieted every single day. So that might be something you want to try, not to plug myself. But yeah, I don't know what people mean when they say that they've been chronically dieting, if that means they've been chronically attempting to lose weight, or have they been chronically in a massive calorie deficit. So there's possibly, I'm going to try to sum this up before I just ramble on incoherently. There's possibilities if you've been too low in calories for too long combined with too much exercise, that there's a stress overload, just like the one we talked about previously, that you may want to address, that you may want to take some time off. And Kevin, that's something you and I can talk about in a bit, but you may just want to take some time off and reset. I mean, this whole thing is transient, right? Weight loss, muscle gain, fat loss, fat gain, the whole thing is really transient. So you can take some time off and make up the ground you lost if you need to. Well, I win the best ramble on FitCast there for sure.
No. Again, well, if it's ever a case where it is kind of going in the wrong direction, I usually butt in. But again, I think it's totally relevant. The thing you kind of just alluded to, and you wrote an awesome blog post up on your you blog at bradpilon.com for people out there who hasn't checked out Brad's stuff, but you did a blog post about your birthday DEXA results, and also this really cool kind of experiment that you did on your own body, whether it be, you know, your training and your diet. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so about 8 weeks ago now, I got the crazy idea. You know, I'd done 1, 2, 3, 4 kind of blatant self-promotion shirtless photo shoots in the last 2 years, right? Just to kind of show that, yes, you can maintain muscle while fasting. And yes, you can get fairly lean while fasting, right? Just kind of that sort of social proof aspect, just to let people know that I'm living the lifestyle I'm promoting. And so I didn't really feel like doing that again, right? It just sort of got a little mundane. So I thought, what would be the exact opposite of that? I mean, what are people really worried about? And what I noticed along with this whole stress thing I've been really kind of noticing in this industry is, man, people are deathly afraid of doing anything that might be counterproductive for their body. Not really understanding that maybe what they're doing right now is in fact counterproductive, because your muscle, the amount of muscle you carry, your fat, the amount of fat you carry, it's all transient. It's all based on your current lifestyle, right? It can change. I read somewhere, and I really wish I remember who said this so I could give them the credit. But someone said something along the lines of, treat your body, you know, as if you're going to have it for the next 80 to 100 years. And I thought that made a lot of sense, because I think I see a lot of people in their, you know, their 20s and early 30s treating their body as if they're, you know, they have to reach some sort of pinnacle now and screw the rest of their life, right? So just destroying it in the gym, just destroying it in dieting and running, just beating it down because they want to look great with no sort of concept of the kind of damage they might be doing for the future. So I'm like, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take 7 weeks off. I'm going to take 7 weeks off of fasting. I'm going to take 7 weeks off of training. 7 weeks off of sort of any sort of cardio. I'm going to be as close to sedentary as possible. I am going to get HBO and I'm going to watch Dexter starting from season 1. And that's going to be my nighttime, you know, workout routine. I don't know, 2.5 hours of Dexter every night kind of thing. Like I'm going for it. I decided to skip the fasting only because I thought, okay, if I do lose muscle, people are going to say it was the fasting. But if I don't lose any muscle, people are going to try to think it's some sort of magic of the fasting. So I got rid of the fasting. I got rid of all the training. I kept the protein intake fairly high only because it's in Canada. It's summer out now and it's barbecue season. So I didn't want to add too many variables. So I did about a shake a day. My protein was probably higher than it normally is, but again, just seasonal variants. And I just did nothing for 7 weeks. And I learned an unbelievable amount in that 7 weeks time. And it's something I would actually encourage anybody who's been training for a long time to try. I mean, Kevin, I don't know about you, Kevin, but this is the first time ever I've taken more than a week or two off on purpose without an injury.
Yeah, right? Without getting sick or something, yeah.
Yeah, like, yeah, you've had the forced layoffs, right, where you've just been – it's something else has done it. I've never had it where it was me just be going, I'm going to take time off.
It's unthinkable, man. How could you do that? I mean, that's what we're kind of tuned to.
Do, right? So the first week was fun, right? It was fun. It was funny. You know, it was kind of the sort of running joke. The second week sucked. The second week is when you look in the mirror and you're like, I'm skinny and I'm fat. And apparently I have the self-esteem of next to nothing. Like it just fell apart. I mean, really, not that much can possibly change in 2 weeks. It's not like I was taking this time off to pig out, right? So, yeah, I was doing, you know, the occasional ice cream, that kind of thing. But I wasn't. There was no force feeding going on, anything along those lines. And I was taking my measurements, so I knew, okay, my waist had gone up a whole half inch. And from the work we've done on body circumferences, I know that, you know, at best a half inch, I'm looking at maybe 2 pounds of fat gain. Like this isn't massive. And then I started sort of watching my weight creep up. And I'm normally at 175, and it crept up to about 180 at the 3 week mark. And that's when I started getting worried. I'm like, I'm going to end this thing in like the 200s, right? And I haven't been in the 200s since I was like bodybuilder bulker back in my early 20s. So I wasn't looking forward to that concept. Then something weird started happening is I started going back down in weight. And slowly from, you know, 179 to 178 to 177, I'm like, this is weird, right? Because the waist circumference is still going up, right? So now the waist is up about a solid inch, which translates to about 5 pounds of fat gain. But my shoulder circumference is down slightly, right? So I'm like, this probably isn't the best thing, but I'm going to keep rolling with it. Long story short, by the end of my 7 weeks, I got a DEXA done. And the fat was up exactly what I thought it was, which is about 5 pounds in 7 weeks. You know, not great, but certainly manageable. The interesting thing was the lean mass was down almost 7 pounds. Now, I don't think, nor do I want to think, that full 7 pounds was actual tissue loss. I think a lot of it is hydration. A lot of it is glycogen. At least that's what I'm, you know, knock on wood, praying. But the interesting thing is I know it's transient. So I know that the... You know, 154 pounds of lean mass I had in my previous DEXAs wasn't because I'm in, you know, awesome genetics from my parents, wasn't because I could just eat whatever I want. It was simply a result of the lifestyle I was living, the fact that I was training. And when you take away that training, you know, that will slowly go away. At the same time, my sort of leanness, again, wasn't just awesome genetics. I certainly can't eat whatever I want whenever I want, because when I remove the fasting and sort of some of the dietary restraint, you know, my weight slowly crept up. And it was really good because, you know, I've been fasting for 7 years now. I've been weight training since high school. I've been lean since high school. I've been that guy with some muscle on him since university. It took some time to get the muscle. You know, so you kind of get delusional thinking that's just who you are. And you dysregulate it from the work you do. And What I really learned from that is that like what the question from about two questions back about aesthetics is that really I'm in this game for aesthetics at this point. I really like to look good. I'm stronger than the average guy, but I'm by no means, you know, strong compared to the most fitness people out there. But I'm interested in looking good, and I want to look good for a long time. And that means, based on this 7 week DEXA, is that I've got to train for a long time, right? It has to be part of my lifestyle for as long as my lifestyle includes a beating heart. So I have to look at how I'm training and think, okay, and what I'm doing now, is it smart? You know, is this something I can maintain? Am I burning myself out? Am I going to break, tear, ruin something? Am I still enjoying training? Because at the end of the day, I mean, I have a gym in the basement. Other than vanity and an interest in health, the one thing that keeps me going downstairs in the morning or at night after the kids have gone to bed is the fact that I really enjoy the feeling of lifting weights, the feeling of moving stuff around. If I lose that, I'll be like just like everybody else. Because, I mean, let's be honest, the people who don't weight train, it's not like they don't sit there at night thinking about their health or how they look in the mirror. They just don't want to go work out. There's something preventing them that they haven't reached that level of enjoyment. And to me, you know, training is almost a form of meditation, right? It's my me time. It's when my mind is kind of flowing but absent at the same time. And I want to keep that. So the 7 week experiment reminded me that it's all transient. And the importance of that transient is for people out there on this call who want to get more muscle or want to lose the fat they have. Well, that's also what you have now is transient. You can fix that by changing your training and training your diet, right? The whole idea of, you know, not being able to change your body, we've proven we can do that. And we've also proven, you know, I did the unthinkable and I was anabolic and catabolic at quote unquote the same time. I just did it wrong and gained fat and lost muscle. But, you know, it's just more evidence that you can, in a short period of time, gain muscle and lose fat. Can you do the two at the exact same time, you know, instantaneously? I don't know. I don't care. What's important is that can you do the same in a relatively short 6 to 7 week period of time? I'm pretty confident that you can. And that's obviously what I'm trying to do now. So, and I'll do another DEXA at the end of the summer, and then that'll be another blog post and kind of the comeback. Obviously, I understand that I'm dealing with muscle memory and the fact that my muscle fibers have a lot of myonuclei in them compared to the average person from all the training I've done. And those nuclei don't go away. So I still have that muscle memory. But that's also very important for a lot of people out there who have been, you know, fit in the past. That's still there, right? You can get it back. So it really was an experience in taking a break, realizing that everything doesn't just simply fall apart when you do that. At the end of the 7 weeks, I was chomping at the bit to get back in the gym and I was ready to start fasting again. And it was a nice mental break. And, you know, my joints don't hurt. My body doesn't hurt. I'm not tired. And I think for a lot of people out there in the fitness niche, so in the non-fitness niche people, the message is everything is transient. You can get on it. You can get training and change your body. For the fitness people out there, if you're really suffering, if you're not enjoying your dieting, if you're not enjoying your workouts, if you're not enjoying your body, a month off may be something you want to try. I mean, if I lost 7 pounds of muscle, supposedly, I bet you it's closer to 3 by the time everything's evened out, and gained 5 pounds of fat in 7 weeks, sorry, then, you know, the changes you would do in a month are probably something you could make back up in the next 3 weeks, right? So yes, during that month, there is the odd chance you may go to a pool party and not be the absolutely most ripped, shredded person at the party. But again, this is all about longevity. And if that means that then you can, you know, take part in training with a renewed enthusiasm for another year or two, then by all means, I think it's a good idea.
I think it's, you know, for a lot of people out there, maybe it's just a message of not getting burned out. You see the people that start in January and go nuts for 3 or 4 weeks, and then they too tired to go back, I guess. I don't know.
No, it's when we have, so the Adonis effect, the Venus factor, the Bin workouts been around with John Barb and I for a while. We do run transformation contests with them. Craig Ballantyne's been running transformation contests forever online. And we've had a lot of people use Eat Stuff Eat and win those contests. The people who win are the people, there's always that sort of balanced, methodical approach to training. They just kind of go, they get it done, they get their dieting done, they get their fasting done. The people who don't win, for a lot, not all of them, obviously, but some of them are always the ones who just, man, they start the race pedal to the metal, right? They just sprint out of the blocks. And then they just crash halfway through the whole process and they just can't keep up the pace. And I think pacing is an important lesson if you're really trying to do this long term.
One other thing that you were talking about on your blog, and I'll let you explain it because you were at the event, but you used a quote that you picked out of there called you pick an apple when it's ripe, and you kind of adapt to that to, you know, the training mindset and stuff like that. Can you talk about that?
Oh, this is awesome. Yeah. So for the Scotch drinkers out there, or for the whiskey drinkers, for those of you over in Scotland and Ireland, I was invited to an event in Canada hosted by the Macallans. And for those of you who don't know the Macallans, shame on you, but the Macallans is a really well-known Scottish whiskey that I highly recommend because it's one of the sort of like creme of the crop whiskeys out there. And the Macallans was launching a new line of Scotch called the Macallan 1824 series. Not to get too much into the Scotch talk, but basically they got rid of the dating of their Scotches and they're going with sort of more of a name based on the color. So it was a gold, a sienna, an amber, and I'm forgetting one. But anyways, that's sort of beside the story. So they flew in their chief wood guy, and I forget his name or his real title, but his job was to oversee the making of the casks. The casks are those giant barrels that the Scotch goes in. Now, keep it with me. I'm going to bring this all back to fitness training in a minute. But they take a lot of pride in these casts, and for good reason, because that's when almost all the flavor comes from, is the interaction with the alcohol that's put into the wood casks and the interaction they have with the wood. That's where they get the flavors, the honey notes, the vanilla notes, the leather, the dried fruit. All those flavor notes come from this aging process inside the wood. So the wood has to be a specific type of wood. In this case, they're only ever oak, made from American oak in the Kentucky area, or Spanish oak. And it's super, super old school the way they make these casks. They're handmade, they're fired, they're aged with sherry, everything you'd expect from a good Scotch cask. Now, this is like a 100-year-old oak that's cut in the planks, and it has to age and it has to dry, right? So they stick it outside. They don't put it in the kiln. It's just literally left outside in these giant, giant sort of fenced off areas, and they age. So they're talking to the chief wood guy, and he's talking to one of the guys over in, I think it was Spain. And it was really interesting. He's trying to get them to explain, like, how do they know when the wood is ready? Like, how long does it take? And like, does it take exactly a certain amount of time? And he's like, no, I can't say anything like we dry the wood for exactly 44 months. He's like, there's too many variables, right? It's how wet was the wood when it was put there? What was the weather like? How much sun did it get? What was the weather like that year? How windy was it, et cetera? He goes, in the end of the day, it's dry when it's dry. And he goes, you pick an apple when it's ripe. And I thought that was really, really profound, right? You pick an apple when it's ripe, because that's exactly when you pick an apple. you don't go and take some scientific measurements on the apple and then pick it. It's ripe, you pick it. And how do you know it's ripe? But from experience. And I think this could be really brought back to exercise and health and training. I think we've lost this, right? To be cliche, no one knows your body like you do. Nobody knows your body like you should. But I think a lot of people have sort of lost that ability to intuitively feel what's going on. I like to talk about calorie counting and suggest that calorie counting is an effective tool for people who are starting out on dieting. But if you use calorie counting as a crutch, you lose the ability to understand the feeling of too much food, too little food, and just enough food. And I mean, that's an intuitive feeling that you should know, right? You should be able to eat without any concept of how many calories are in your food, because let's face it, it's the calorie in your food is about a 50, 60-year-old thing at most. Before that, we just sort of had food. And it's not, I'm not going back to the 1800s here, right? We're 1930, 1940s, even 1950s. The calorie wasn't just this thing that everybody knew about. You just knew how much to sort of eat. And I think we've lost that. And it comes back to training too, right? With training, we rely so heavily on the programming of our experts. No offense, Kevin. But a lot of us have lost the ability to know, like, when is your muscle done? When is it exhausted, right? Your program calls for 5 sets of 5, but what on the 4th set, you're done? Would you know, right? Or what if on the 5th set you realized, I wasn't quite in the groove. I've got more in me. Can you do more, or should you stick with the 5th set? If your workout says a minute rest, and for the first 3 sets you do a minute rest and it feels great, and on the 4th set a minute didn't feel right, would you know what not right felt like? You wake up on a Wednesday and Wednesday's your deadlift day, and you don't quite feel like you should deadlift. Would you know if that feeling is a legit, you should not deadlift that day because your lower back's a bit odd? Or is that something that's just because the way you slept last night and a couple warm-up sets and you'll be good? So this whole you pick an apple when it's ripe process of understanding or identifying with your past experiences of how your body works is, I think, something we've lost. We've crutched on a blend of internet experts and the what you should do's, and instead, we've done that, instead of really sort of figuring out what's working, what's not working for our body. I mean, I can take this right back to that stress talk we just talked about, but the amount of people who are layering stresses on top of stresses on their bodies and not sort of changing things up or adapting, it kind of scares me, right? It's completely fine if work has gotten massively stressful, and if your home life is massively stressful, or you're in exams at school, it's not a failure if you cut down your workout load from 5 workouts a week to 3 to manage that stress. I mean, that's smart. That's listening to what's going on. It's understanding what's going on with your body. You know, if you're dieting extremely heavily, extremely hard, I guess is a better term. If you're dieting extremely hard for a contest and you cut your workouts down from 5 to 3 workouts in 7 days, you know, that might not be the worst thing to do, especially if you did it not because someone else told you to do it, but because you're starting to feel a little beaten down. So end of day, when it comes to how much calories you should eat or how often you should work out or even how much protein, how many sets and reps, how many days off, the whole thing, you look to the experts for advice, but at the very end of the day, you pick an apple when it's ripe. You've got to know what's going on with you. So that was, again, another sort of stress management thing, but I've noticed that the amount of people who come to me like, Brad, I'm not losing weight, but I'm eating 2,134 calories a day, and that's exactly the amount I should be based on my metabolic rate of 1,734 plus 328 calories walking around and 300 for my workout. I don't get why I'm not losing weight. I'm like, well, it's awesome you know all these crazy numbers, but at end of day, you tell me, right? Are you eating too little, too much, you know, the right amount? Like, it's the intuition has been replaced by sort of the Excel spreadsheet of your daily workouts, your daily calories. And I think that's holding some people back. Not everybody, because I think you need a grasp of what a calorie is. You need that basic understanding. But it gets to the point where sometimes you kind of gotta move away from your spreadsheet and just kind of do what's going to feel best.
No, I think that's a fantastic point. I think a lot of people, at least when it comes to like my clients and stuff like that, that's why whenever they come in, I ask them, you know, how are you feeling today? How was your day? Because sometimes you might need to adjust on the fly. I just, you know, like you were saying, it really kind of bugs me when there's trainers out there that say, yeah, even if you feel like shit, you know, I'm going to make you do like 400 burpees, because that makes a lot of sense as a training setup. So, yeah, no, that's super cool stuff. And it's a great way to put it. I just love the way you kind of put it in the blog post.
It's funny, weird things you get from, like, this is why we've got to take breaks from fitness every once in a while. I mean, I went to a Scotch launch party and I came back with one of my better blog posts of the year, I think, right? So, yeah.
No, but for sure.
Finding the unity. I read somewhere a long time ago someone talking about something like this, and I actually thought it was silly. And he was talking about deadlifting. He's like, you know, there are days where I go in and the deadlift just doesn't feel right. So, you know, I do my 3 or 4 sets and I'm out. He goes, but there are days where, you know, I did the 3 sets, it was written down, and I just felt awesome, so I kept going. I did a couple more sets and maybe went for a max that day, even though it wasn't planned. And back then, I remember thinking, that's stupid. You got to stick to your plan. But now I kind of get it. I'm like, man, if you're having a strong day where all the joints feel great, then you use that day, right? But if you're having a bad day where it doesn't feel right, then you're smart. You just do the minimum and move on to something else. And now I get that advice, and go figure, the guy who wrote it back in the day was, I think he was in his 50s, and I read it when I was like early 30s, right? So, you know, it's experience counts for something, for sure.
Absolutely. Well, finally, could you talk a little bit about, obviously, Eat Stop Eat, new edition has been released. Can you talk about some of the updates to the book and how people can get a hold of that?
Yeah. So I update this book pretty much annually. What I try to do is when blog posts or articles come out that shed new light, good or bad, on fasting, I kind of take note. But I found there's no value in me hopping on the blog post and leaving a comment or you know, same thing with the Facebook, because I'm obviously biased, right? I wrote a book on fasting, so anything I say in that atmosphere is going to come across as just me defending the book. So what I do is I pull all the, if it's not a reference post, I rarely give it the time of day, because, you know, if it doesn't lead me somewhere, all I get is opinion. But if it's referenced, I'll pull the references, I'll put them together in one group, and I'll read through them. And then if it means then following the trail of those references to the earlier work, I'll do that. And then if there's a story there, it'll get included in the new Eat Stop Eat. Now, I feel that's my way to give an educated opinion on what's going on online, as opposed to sort of jumping in, especially if I jump in emotionally. So it means that I get to give my view on things a little late in the game, but I know that it's well done and well researched. So this year, I thought definitely the gender differences was something I had to discuss. And, you know, I think on this podcast, it may come across that I kind of downplayed differences a bit, because they are there. But I really wanted to upplay the fact that I think men need to be aware of it too. But in the book, I do go into some of the gender differences, what hormones change quicker or slower in men and women, etc. And I think that that chapter definitely needed to be in there, especially for the women who are starting to play with the longer fasts or the fasting plus the dieting, et cetera, that just need to be aware of some of the things they should be looking for. So that was one of the main changes. In line with that was my explanation of longer fasts. And I wanted them to make sure that the reader understood that there was a reason I picked 24 hours. It wasn't just because it was a nice, convenient number. I mean, that's awesome. But there's a reason I didn't just go 48 or 72. And while my research was originally on 12 to 72 hours of fasting time, and I called that short-term fasting, I think it's important to point out that, you know, a 72-hour fast is what, threefold the length of a 24-hour fast? I mean, it's a different beast altogether. And yes, it's still short-term fasting, but it's 3 days, right? With each sub eat, it's designed so you eat every single day. With a 72-hour fast, you're going a full 3 without any food whatsoever. And so different things happen at the end of a 72-hour fast than they do at the end of a 24-hour fast. And I really wanted to get that across, that 24 wasn't by mistake. You know, it wasn't just an arbitrary number. I didn't just randomly pick it. It was my best guess at the length of fasting the majority of people could handle. You know, if I thought everybody could handle 72, I probably would have done 72 because I would have been able to make like awesome lose 8 pounds in the first 3 days type of claims. But I didn't think that would work. The point I also made in the longer fast chapter was that an area of fasting that's really, really important that I think is going to get a lot of time and research in the future is the time after a fast. I mean, one of the best questions to ask in research is what happens next. And I think with fasting, one of the big questions is what happens next? And not just in these 2 to 3 hours after a fast, but the 12, 18. You know, I'd like to see a trial where people are fasted for 24, 48, 72 hours, and then they maintain measurements for the 12, 24, 36, 48 hours afterwards and really see what kind of rebound and cyclical effects we see. Because jumping from longer fast to the changes in testosterone, the work I found on this year on testosterone and fasting was very interesting. So I found that, yes, in fact, longer-term fasts will cause a slow, steady decline in man's testosterone levels. What I found was really interesting is when you refeed these men, and we're not talking massive calorie amounts, we're talking 1,500 calories per day, we saw a very large, pronounced spike on testosterone levels well above basal levels, the pre-fasting levels. This spike happened within like the first 36 hours after they started the refeeding and lasted for the full 4 days that they measured. So it's not like it came back down after the 4 days, they just stopped measuring. And that was a great example of the what happens next. So if you just left it at the 9-day trial, you'd be like, oh, okay, these guys' testosterone levels dropped and done, story's over. But by looking for the 4 days after, we're like, wow, it drops. And then there's some sort of weird rebound that happens after. And I think that's really important. I think that it plays into maybe a longer term view of the role that fasting plays in overall nutrition. Is that even the period of time spent eating after a fast might have different effects than the period before. A great example of that is all the amino acid trials that we use to prove that amino acids cause protein synthesis. And I'm sorry for the way I say synthesis. Whenever I do an interview, I mess it up for some reason. Those trials are always done in people who are at least overnight fasted. Then they come into the lab. Then they sit down. They rest. They get the catheters put in. They rest a bit longer. Half the time, we're looking at a 14 to 18 hour fast before the amino acids are even being infused. Right, so those amino acid trials showing that amino acids cause increases in protein synthesis, the vast majority of them actually show that amino acid feeding after a 14-18 hour fast causes increases in muscle protein synthesis. Right, so we can't just leave that fasting part out anymore. It's part of the trial. It's part of the experiment, and recognizing that could really play a role in how we plan or program for fasting. If you move away from sort of the eat, stop, eat, fast once or twice a week when it fits you best, and you move into a more tactical version of fasting, maybe having like something you would do with high-level athletes, this kind of information is going to be invaluable. So I added that into the testosterone chapter as well, just to kind of put that seed out there. I updated the leptin chapter. It's not that I downplayed leptin on the first couple editions of ESOP where leptin made an appearance. But I just sort of covered the part that was in the mainstream media at the time. And at the time, mainstream media was the suggestion that leptin could cause massive changes in your metabolic rate. And we just didn't find that in human research. So I stated, despite what people say, leptin doesn't cause massive changes in metabolic rate. And I left it at that. And that was probably a mistake on my part, because I think what came across from that was that leptin's not important, period. Brad Pelon said so. And so I really wanted to get across in this chapter that leptin's actually very important. I mean, it may not be the master fat-burning hormone, but it's definitely one of the master regulating hormones in your body. I kin leptin to inflammation. And if you guys know my theory on inflammation, it's that chronic changes in elevation, whether in inflammation, are actually bad for you, right? The chronic systemic increases in inflammation tend to be related with a whole host of disease states. However, acute increases in inflammation are involved in good things, like the muscle building process, for instance. And I see leptin is the same way, right? Where acute changes in leptin, either up or down, may have benefits to the human body. Chronic changes in leptin outside of what we consider normal levels, either too high we find in obesity or too low when we find in massively overtrained athletes, probably is indicative of a host of problems. Especially since there's a connection between overtraining leptin and reproduction function, right? So I added all that in just to make sure people understood that leptin is a very important hormone, and that, you know, perhaps in the earlier stages of ESOP, I dismissed it too quickly, just thinking people were only interested in the metabolic rate aspect. So I really sort of fleshed that one a little bit more so people could understand leptin's role in human physiology in total. And then finally, the chapter I'm most happy with, which I think really explains my views of ESOP the best, is the one where I explain fasting is a form of physical training. And that's where I explain that, you know, just like weight training, fasting is a physical stress that we use to elicit an adaptive response that causes the benefits we want. So in that sense, you know, at short periods of abstaining from calorie intake is a form of physical training. And as such, it needs recovery. Just like weight training, you just can't do it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You need rest. I think the same thing is true of fasting. And that is the rationale behind the setup of VSOP, which is a 24-hour fast followed by anywhere from 2 to 6 days of normal maintenance eating. I view that as recovery time. I'm not a large fan of the fast and feast mentality, you know, so fasting followed by giant feasts, etc. But it's not my approach. And my approach isn't a daily fast, right? So I have no real issues with daily fasts, especially the ones that are planned smartly, where, you know, the fast is like 16 hours long as opposed to 18, 20, 24. And I know that lots of people out there have had amazing results with 20-hour fasts a day and 4-hour eating windows, the whole bit. But again, ESOP Eat is written for the vast majority of people, and it's my style. And my style is fasting is a form of physical training. It's a combination of fasting and recovery. So the fasting is a physical training. The gender differences are the main new chapters. The leptin and the testosterone are the main improved chapters, as well as the one on longer fast. And the whole point of this update was to really give people a clearer definition of what ESOP Eat is. Now that intermittent fasting is so popular and there are so many versions, I really want to make sure you understood that ESOP Eat wasn't just intermittent fasting, but it was its own style, right? And it needed to be kind of addressed as such. So that was the main point of this update. It's one of my, you know, I'm really happy with this version. I think I've covered all of the latest fasting research that came out since the last version. I've included the newer information as well as some new weight loss information in general. And I think I've came out with a very complete view of what ESOP Eat is. So now it's not just a book on fasting, but it really explains why it's set up and planned the way it was.
Very cool. I mean, it's a huge, like, incredibly complete package. Because, again, I think there are people who are just introduced to intermittent fasting. There are lots of questions. And the great thing about, you know, what I think you do with Eat Stop Eat is it just answers everything. And it's why when people ask about it, I usually send them your way, just because it makes the most sense. And I mean, man, you've been looking into this stuff and researching it for, God, what, like 10, 15 years now?
Yeah. If you count the time I spent, well, my undergrad doing applied nutrition, and then time I spent doing sports supplement research, so for like bodybuilding type stuff, then the grad work, which was the fasting, and then it's been, well, forever. Yeah. It's been fun because they've been very different directions in the same field, right? If you think of the research I would have done designing creatine supplements and the like to then studying fasting, I mean, I've gone not quite 360, but very different paths in the same venue. So I do think I have a lot to offer that way, right? I do understand the bodybuilding mentality. I understand supplement mentality, obviously. And to bring that into fasting, I can really dovetail it all together for people. At least that's my goal.
Oh, very cool. All right, so everyone out there, you can check out the book at eatstopeat.com. I'll also throw a link in the show notes if you can't remember the link. It's pretty simple, though. And also, you can check out Brad's blog at bradpilon.com. Well, Brad, thank you so much for spending some time this morning and talking about this. It's always super interesting and really great to have you on. So we'll definitely talk to you, hopefully not a year from now, hopefully before that, but we'll definitely talk again down the road.
Perfect. All right. Thanks a lot, Kevin.
Thank you.